My name is Wanda Stephen Jamijumba Patrick. My father comes from the Eastern Snake clan group. He's what we consider Wanayaka. I'm called Wandari Dari. Wandari in Gif. And I want to crown you lot with the original crown of this country, the Southern Cross. You can be called Australian. You'll be called Australia if you know the land, because it'll know you. Maintain the balance, live in harmony, because that's what the Ngatilka says. That's the whole name for Australia. Ngatilka means two mothers. Adoption is a big part in our ceremony too. That's why Jariwanpa ceremony, our reconciliation ceremony, tells me that I should accept everyone, regardless of where they come from or what nation they are, if they adopt this country and the ways of this country. Matilka, I'm a guardian for that one. I'll do my best to teach you this. Normally you would go to ceremony and nearly half of your life you have to learn all these things and then teach others to pass it on. Walubere, pass the flame. Lose the flame and your identity doesn't exist anymore. In doing that, your country's identity is gone too. Ceremony is to pass on this knowledge, not keep it to myself. So this is why I'm telling this story. Yeah, my country, our country. So I want to share the knowledge about the ultimate kangaroo, the ultimate emu.
Welcome to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio. I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present, and to acknowledge that sovereignty over this land was never ceded. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase the range of programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling, and food addictions. Today I'm here with Keely. Thank you for coming on the show, Keely.
Thank you for having me.
Cool. So basically for Keely and for those who haven't tuned into the program before, we're going to showcase Keely's journey with alcohol and alcohol addiction and the recovery from alcohol addiction. So basically we'll start growing up, your family environment, what kind of led you to the development of your addiction, how that kind of progressed, and then we'll kind of get into the recovery towards the end of the show.
Awesome.
And have a bit of fun while we do it.
Yay!
You know?
Yes!
It doesn't have to be so
okay.
Despondent. So if you could tell me a little bit, just to begin with, what it was like for you growing up, your family environment, and yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's funny because I feel like my story has changed since coming into recovery. You know, I used to always think that I had a really beautiful childhood growing up, I actually thought it was quite healthy, and I was more than spoiled. You know, we got to go all over the world, and you know, in reflection, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad's an alcoholic, so it was quite chaotic. But to me, younger, it just looked so colourful. You know, we had the beautiful bar, and there was always parties every weekend. And what I used to think, everybody was just so happy. And now when I look back, I remember mum crying often. You know, I remember.
What did you think of that at the time? Like, do you remember?
At that young age, I just didn't understand.
Yeah.
As a teenager, I started to really resent dad because then I could see that it was the drinking.
Yeah.
And then as I started my drinking journey, I started to have compassion for him. And then because I was drinking like him, I was a bit like, oh, mum's just this, like, you know, just let us party.
She doesn't get it.
Yeah, she just doesn't get it. Party pooper. There's always something wrong, you know. Yeah, but so it was confusing. Like, and I was an incredibly shy little girl. And that's what probably I loved most about alcohol in the beginning, was it gave me the confidence that I could never, ever bring about on my own.
Yeah, brought you out of your shell.
Oh yeah.
Okay. And so your mum being upset, that was a response to your dad?
Drinking. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What was their kind of dynamic?
So they grew up, they're English. They married when they were like 16, so crazy young. Dad was alcoholic from the get-go. Mum will always share, you know, when she was pregnant with my brother in England, she'd had to carry dad through the snow because he was wasted,
right,
and she's heavily pregnant, and that's their story.
That's stressful.
Yeah. And it just continued.
Okay.
Did
they kind of drink? Did they have the same kind of patterns when they drank, like the same amounts and stuff? Different.
Yeah, very different. Mum will just have a few drinks, loosen up, and then stop because she don't like the feeling of getting drunk. And dad, like me, once you get that feeling, it's like, let's go.
Chasing the dragon.
It's game on. Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah. Okay.
So, and mum just wasn't interested in it, you know, at all. But I suppose, you know, they come from that generation that you commit, you make that commitment and you stay put, no matter how happy, unhappy.
And school, what was it like for you at school growing up? You said you were shy.
Yeah, so shy. Shy in kinder. I got held back in kinder because I was so shy. I was scared of the boys, which definitely changed. And primary school, I was the kid that would go along with what the bully wanted, you know, because I wanted to hide behind and not get bullied.
That's often how that works. I feel like that's how they kind of impose power.
Yeah. And if I stay close to you, you can't get me.
That's right.
Is the hope. They still got me.
Yeah.
But then in high school, I had a shift and I just became a part of the party group, where we all just connected. There was none of that.
Yeah.
And I loved high school.
Yeah.
Yeah. But primary school, I wasn't a fan of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time you went to a party or your first time drinking? What was that like?
I'd had alcohol before, like as a really young girl, because dad used to, when he'd cut the grass, take a little esky out. Being an alcoholic, like you can't pause.
How are you supposed to cut the grass?
You don't want to walk into the house and, you know.
No.
So he'd take an esky, he'd crack open the VB and I'd have a little sip, and it was like such a moment of connection, and it was mine and dad's little thing. So I'd had it quite young, but I can't remember my first party. I probably started drinking at about 14 because I got stoned at 13 and that didn't do much for me. But started drinking and I drank alcoholically from the get-go. Not that I drank every day, but once I have one, like I don't just want one or two.
Okay.
I'll drink as much as my body can take in.
Yeah. Okay. So more following the pattern of your dad than your mum.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Okay.
Yeah. And yeah, so I guess the first time you got drunk, what was that experience like?
Oh, wonderful.
It was cool.
Yeah. Strongbows. Like I said, I get all like this amazing confidence. Back then I could remember, you know, my whole night, and I'm one of those ones that doesn't really suffer from a hangover. So it was like, I can't wait to do that again.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And every time from that, I can't wait to do that again.
Can't wait to do it again. Yeah. Okay. And, kind of your friends the same? Were you kind of mirroring?
Yeah. That was the thing. We all, like, you know, you'd party on weekends.
Yeah.
Everyone was so excited for, and so we would party every weekend, and that it didn't look unusual because we were all doing it.
So normalized.
So normal.
Yeah. And would your friends get hangovers as well?
Yeah. And they would drink more than me. So they would look like they were going to be the one with the problem.
Okay.
But then they grew up.
Yeah. And you're like, I have this superpower, you know, I don't deal with that.
Oh, I just, like, I'm so carefree.
Yeah.
I'm like, when I drink, I become the person that I wish I could always be. That I'm just too shy to be.
Yeah, okay. But that kind of unlocks the key for me. When
it's the only.
Yeah.
The only door.
Yeah. Did you ever, like, confide in your friends about your parents drinking or anything like that?
My house was the house that was the party house. So
true. Yeah. The bar
so,
and everything.
And as teenagers, everyone was allowed to come to my house and drink. Mm. And whether their parents know or not, I'm not sure. My dad would drink with my mates.
Yep.
So everyone thought it was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. No, who doesn't like the fun party dad?
Yeah. You've got a space to go to.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's what kids, I feel like, kind of want the most.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so kind of demonized. And yeah, if your parents aren't buying you drinks kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, my best mate's mom is having a party there. So it's just like, especially if, you know, your parents are friends with the parents of your friends and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Were there any parties that got like particularly like out of hand or anything like that?
Not as young ones. Yeah, you know, it was just mucking about, passing out. All my parties got out of hand in my 20s.
Okay.
You know, but yeah, not that I can remember.
Sure. Yeah. And there was like a bit of not remembering probably around that stage.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you kind of had that negative experience, when you were drinking?
It would have been not necessarily negative, decisions that I made when drinking, you know, waking up the next day going, oh my God, I can't believe I'm at his house you know, I can't believe I said that. But I could kind of, I always justified any behavior.
Okay.
Always.
Yeah.
It really started to impact me after I had my children.
Okay.
That's when the disease really kicked off.
Yeah. Okay.
For me.
And I feel like addicts are quite good at justifying those kind of decisions.
Yeah.
It's a learned skill.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah.
So when you were drinking, you would drink a little bit more like your dad than what you were drinking like your mum.
Yeah.
So in what kinds of ways, would that kind of manifest, I guess?
You know, before coming into recovery, my mum used to say, you're just like your father.
Mm.
And I didn't know the language around this disease, but to me it was, I just don't have an off switch. So, you know, as when you're young, you can only drink as much as you're
can drink.
Yeah, yeah. But like it would get to a point where I would be taking others or, you know, like sneakily hiding mine so nobody could get on my stash, take theirs so that I've still got plenty, you know, that fear
just
of
really,
running out.
Yeah.
And that was exactly like dad.
Okay.
You couldn't touch his beers. If he went out to a friend's, he had to bring it home. He wouldn't leave. You know, normal people like, oh, no, just leave it. You have it.
Don't worry about
it. Yeah, yeah. Nah. You could not touch dad's beer. And I was very much like that at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Me and mum used to have like a glass of wine and she was always so clumsy. She'd knock it over. And I would be like, you can't, like, I'm not pouring some of mine into yours. Like, I got so
protective almost. Yeah.
And I'd like measure, you know, there had to be the exact same amount. She couldn't have a mouthful more of mine.
Yeah, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Next level.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, you know that now, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah.
Okay, and what about, you know, getting out of high school? Did you go to like college or what was that like transitioning?
Straight to school, straight to work.
Yep. Straight to work? Yep. Yeah, okay. Yep. And yeah, how did your drinking kind of transition into working in your
20s? As I said, probably like, you know, in my 20s, it was, I want to say, under control.
Mm.
I would still be able to, like, I worked full time.
Yeah.
I could.
Like functioning.
Yeah. Yeah. I would, you know, I started like as a teenager, weekends. And then as I got older, it was like, you know, I'll have a drink Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Mm-hmm. And then another day was added. And then another day. In the end, I just it was everyday drinking in the very end.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I started working, I had things that could control my drinking for quite a while.
Okay.
And then it flipped where the drinking just revolved.
Yeah, okay.
You know, everything went in a backseat.
Yeah. What were those things that could help control the drinking?
The work, you know, socializing, the commitments that maybe I made with people.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you find, like, were you still hanging out with the friends from high school that you were drinking with? Did that carry over as well?
Some, but I always found like-minded people.
Right, right.
I always associated myself with alcoholics.
Yeah.
Because then there's no one can look at me, you know?
Yeah.
My first husband was an alcoholic, so I can always hide behind that person. Or I go, oh, well, see, there's nothing wrong with me. They're doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I knew, I'd known since my early 20s I was an alcoholic. The only thing that I had promised myself was I just wasn't going to put it before my family like I felt my dad had done.
Right, okay.
That was the only...
Non-negotiable.
Yeah, non-negotiable, and I well and truly crossed over that.
Okay, yeah. We'll get to that in the next bracket. Yeah. Might just go to a song. So the song that we're about to play is a song by Mac DeMarco, and it's called Annie.
Oh,
Welcome back to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio. I'm here with Keely, and we've been discussing Keely's addiction and recovery from alcohol addiction. So we're at the stage now in your 20s where metaphorically the wheels start to fall off a little bit. So yeah, if you could catch us up a little bit on what that looked like. And walk us through that.
Yeah. So, you know, I suppose I always have felt like a little bit odd, you know, that everybody seemed to get the manual to life and I missed out on it. And I always felt like just empty.
Right.
So I thought that I just had to follow in mum's footsteps to all of a sudden feel happier. If I just get married, if I have children, buy the house, do all that, I'll just start feeling happier.
Tick the boxes.
Yeah, tick the boxes, because by like mid-20, like, you know, 20 to 26, so it was just all fun. It was just partying. Party, holidays, you know. But I'd slowly start to just feel, I'd see people growing up and I just felt empty.
Mm.
Yeah. And so I thought, well, I'll just get married and it doesn't matter if the love's not there. I've just got to do that. That's the next step.
Yeah.
And
that's what mum did.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I did that. I got married. It wasn't a very happy marriage and it wasn't a very long one, but in that short space we had children, because again it's like, well, let's do the next thing, have children. As soon as I had children, that's when the wheels went.
Okay.
Was
it that sense of kind of fulfillment, that like filling that hole, that emptiness kind of thing?
Yeah, I used to think, why did my disease progress so quickly from that moment? And I thought it was because I just have all this time on my hands. I'm a mum. I'm a new mum. I'm at home. But I realized, like, I was so scared of looking after a little human. So scared. Like, I never had to be responsible. You know, I could drink and do whatever I wanted. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
I was the only one getting hurt. But now I've got these little tiny babies.
And just like that, you know.
Oh, and it's so scary that the only solution I've got is to just drink more.
Yeah.
And because then I drank more, I got even unhappier. I start like diagnosing myself, thinking I've got postnatal depression. It must be the husband.
I
know I'm an alcoholic, but he's really an alcoholic.
Yeah, he's
worse than me. Yeah. So I'll get rid of him and this will solve all my problems.
Were you confiding in him about how you were feeling at the time about this?
No, I didn't tell anybody. I don't know, how dark can you get on this?
As dark as you want, because we always bounce back.
Okay, you know? So I remember when my firstborn was 4 months old and I was sat on the couch and I just opened my second bottle of red wine and I thought, this is how I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to go in a car, I'm going to, you know, gas myself and this, like, I've got nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to take myself out because I can't do this.
Yep.
And again, it's like, just have another drink.
Yeah.
You know, I could, tomorrow, we can deal with this. Everything was tomorrow for me.
Yeah, sure.
But once, you know, once I just was like, I remember saying to him that we just party too hard and he always wanted to kind of get rid of me and the kids so that he could go out. So
by himself?
With his mates.
With his mates.
Whereas I was like a sophisticated alcoholic.
Oh, okay.
You know, drinking at home, drinking the cask wine at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, I felt like, I kind of felt like he was dragging me down or maybe making
my sophistication.
Yeah. And like enabling, because when I would say like, oh, maybe we need to, no, you know.
Yeah.
So I booted him out and then I just got worse.
Yeah, right.
I got way worse.
Yep.
And
now I guess like now you don't have like a support system.
Yeah.
So you got to deal with that.
Yeah.
With the drinking.
Yeah.
So was there a specific incident where you were like, okay, it's time for you to go kind of thing, or was it like a build up?
You know what? It was just that I didn't love him.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's the way I was in my alcoholism is I get what I want and then I get bored and then chuck it aside. Next. And he was just another next.
Mm-hmm.
Got rid of him. And I felt so free that it was like, oh, party time.
Finally.
Yeah. I felt so free. And I had these like kind of, during the weeks where I had to control my drinking, which is really uncomfortable for an alcoholic. And then when the boys would go to their dad's, it's let rip on the weekend, back to controlled drinking during the week.
And still working. And
still, no, I had stopped working by then. I was only doing like one day a month and my mum would look after the boys.
Yep.
So very much, I had a lot of time on my hands.
Okay.
A lot of time.
Yeah, okay. And how are your parents feeling about your relationship and your drinking at that time? Did they really know?
We're so glad that the relationship was over.
Yeah.
Nobody in my family has commented on my drinking ever, apart from you need to just slow down.
Slow down.
And I think that's because there's only like, you know, because of mum and dad coming from England, there's only four of us in Australia. We're really codependent.
Sure, yeah.
And like, we all go to each other to fix each other's problems. So whilst I was just like my father, I was also like mum's best friend. And she, you know, she wasn't like me and dad, but she did like to have a drink here and there and party. We'd go out dancing together. So if she was to suggest me stopping, she was going to lose that best friend, party best friend.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, slow down, I guess that's not really direct or practical really. It's kind of shrouded in that fear of, wanting you to do something about it, but not wanting you to do really too much about it at the same time, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. So that relationship ends. Mm. And how does your drinking progress from there? Once
just the, more
and
way
more. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, well, not always every day at that stage. Was everyday drinking was in the last year of my drinking, but it just got, I don't know. It was like I was going back in age and I was acting out and moral compass was way off.
Yeah, right.
Way off. And it was knowing that I crossed that line that I said I never would do was too horrible to sit with.
So you realize that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, I'm just like my dad.
Mm-hmm.
The alcohol is more important than my children.
Yeah, that must have been pretty,
it's
dark.
Horrific. It's a horrible feeling. And, you know, the boys saying, oh, we're at mummy's favourite shop, which was Dan Murphy's. Like, they knew it.
Home away from home.
Oh, God. Yeah. And it was just like, I can't deal with these feelings, so I just have to drink more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always drank for the effect, but it became, I'm getting more and more uncomfortable. I'm more and more in fear. I need more and more to numb this.
Okay.
And that's where it went from fun, happy times to this is my medicine.
Coping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I can have a drink, I can get through the day.
Yeah. And when did you first seek out recovery? Was there a point where you realized that, or how did you become familiar with it kind of thing?
Yeah. So in my last year of drinking, I had made the promise that I'd never made to anybody in my life. And this was to my now husband, that I would cut down, I would control my drinking. And it.
What did that look like?
Oh, my God, this story is insane. And I don't know if we'll have the time to go through it all, but.
Yeah, we can try. Yeah.
Okay, so I had to get in my head like, all right, what would a normal drinker drink? How many would I have where I feel good and relaxed, but I don't lose the plot?
Mm.
So I came up with the idea of four. I can only have
normal
four.
Drinker.
Yes, that's a normal drinker. Four drinks every single day, mind you, which I don't think that's normal.
No, we just did air quotations on normal drinker as well.
So I got a diary and I wrote Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then I draw a little glass of wine every time I have a drink in this book.
Okay.
I get to the end of my first week and it's messy.
Okay, it's all over the place.
Yeah. And I don't know why, because clearly I fail controlled drinking in that 1 week, but then I've convinced myself that I'm onto something.
Yes.
So then my next idea was every time I have a drink, I'm going to put a bracelet on. I bought four bracelets. They would fall off. I'm a nutcase when I'm drunk, right?
Okay.
And I'm a blackout drinker, so I don't remember anything either.
Yeah, sure.
I still think I'm onto something, but I just need something more permanent. So I got this tattoo on my finger, which
tallies.
Is like four.
Yep. Yeah, I can see that.
In the idea that I'll look at my drinking hand.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the wine glasses to the bracelets to the tattoo.
Yeah, to the tattoo. That insane thinking of the alcoholic that I can do. So I tried this controlled drinking for a whole entire year.
Yeah.
And then it got to a point like, I can't do this. I have to stop.
Yep.
And
were you coming up with those solutions yourself?
Yeah.
You were maybe just like a bit of brainstorming.
Yeah, all by myself. Mm-hmm. And like everybody was really supportive because they could see I was trying to do my best.
You were trying, yeah.
But geez, they must have been laughing behind my back.
This is not the most straightforward way of dealing with that.
Yeah.
So you realized that this controlled drinking wasn't going to work. Yeah,
it's horrible. I'm a nightmare. I'm horrible to this new beautiful man that I'm with. I've got to stop. And day one, I like, this is it. I'm stopping drinking. And 7 days of being sober, and it was horrific.
Mm.
I even went to a music festival in my first week. Like, I don't know why I did that.
Sober? Yeah, wow.
Like, I think it was like 5 days and I just wanted to like hide from, it was horrible.
Okay.
And on the 7th day I thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this on my own. And I just Googled. I actually first come across, is it Russell Brand?
Yeah, Russell Brand. Yeah.
He on Instagram was talking about the 12 steps.
Yep.
And I thought if I just did a step every day for 12 days, I'll be fine.
Oh, yeah, that's how it works. Yeah.
And apparently that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I Googled AA and I rung this number and I said, I'm looking on the AA Times website and there's a meeting around the corner from my house. Do you think it will be okay for me? He's like, if you're an alcoholic, any meeting is going to be okay.
It'll be okay.
For you.
Yeah.
And that was my journey. Often running into AA.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And the first meeting, how did that kind of go?
It was horrible. I was in the car and I was by myself and I looked out and there were people standing around the front door smoking and I thought, I can't get out of the car.
Mm.
Like if I had a few wines, I certainly maybe can, and everybody would be my best friend.
Isn't that the ironic thing about
that? Isn't it?
That?
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Big time. So something got me out of that car. It took a while. And all I remember from my first meeting, people will say, oh, I hope, and that wasn't my experience. But the only thing that I remember was a guy that come up to me and he was so lovely, looked like the dad from Shameless.
Oh, okay.
The drunk dad.
Yes, yep. William Macy?
Yes.
I think,
yeah.
Yeah.
And for some reason, because it was like he looked like the drunk, I don't know, it felt like
association.
Oh, yeah. Okay, this is the right place. And I don't remember what they talked about. I think I shared. I would have been shaking. All I did was shake and cry.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting what kind of compels someone or the specific things that someone will pick up on in their first meeting that like they think. The phrase terminal uniqueness, are you familiar with that?
Yes.
That kind of pulls them out of this kind of terminal uniqueness, this feeling of these issues are so specific to me that no one's going to understand this, that I'm here, but like no one really gets what I'm going through. But it's something specific like recognizing the guy from Shameless that makes you go, oh, hold on, I might come back. Like this is familiar in a way I didn't expect.
Kind
of thing.
Yeah, the first 4 months, I did a lot of meetings where there wasn't a lot of talking about recovery and the 12 steps, and I nearly went back out and drunk. But then when I found recovery-based meetings, game changer.
Okay.
Absolute game changer.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So for people listening, what's kind of the difference between those two?
Yeah, so the ID meetings... it's set up so you would share almost like what we're doing today, what it was like, what happened towards the end, how did I find AA, and what my life is like today because of the 12 steps. It's a bit like Chinese whispers though, because the message apparently has been really washed out, and I'd go to these meetings and they would just share on what it was like.
Right.
The crashing and the bashing. And I thought, I know this story.
Yeah, yeah.
So well.
Yeah.
And
this isn't helping me personally.
At all. And they would finish this long share and then say, just don't drink one day at a time. And say, really?
All of that.
That's all you've got?
Yeah, yeah.
Like how I'm dying here.
Uh-huh.
And then I found this recovery meeting. Someone had suggested it to me. And then they were talking about, it was a little bit of what it was like so I could identify. But then they were talking about how amazing life was and learning about themselves and learning about the illness and the 12 steps and connection and just every, like it absolutely opened my world up.
Yeah, okay. Through learning about your disease
through doing
itself.
Step work.
Okay.
Getting a sponsor. Like there's a lot of suggestions in AA. And you're just guided. You know, if you've got a sponsor, you'll sit with them and you'll go through what we call the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and do the step work and learn about ourselves, not in a self-help program, but just kind of, they say there's a lot of like one-liners and stuff, but, you know, doing the step work is uncovering, discovering and discarding.
Right.
And then, you know, ideally AA is to help you connect with a higher power and to help others.
Yep.
Sacrifice.
What did that higher power look like for you? Are you a religious person?
No. And it was so daunting, because when I came in, everybody was like, it's a spiritual program, not a religious program. But all I see on the walls is God.
The word God?
Yeah.
Yeah.
God?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a start in the Serenity Prayer.
It's pretty religious.
It's throughout the big book. Mm. I see it everywhere. And they're telling me to pray. They're telling me to get down on my knees and pray. And I'm thinking, somebody's lying.
Yeah, that's really religious at that point.
Yeah. And I fought it for the whole year. Mm. Like, and I kept missing the part where it's like in the book it says, of your own a God of your own understanding.
Yes, it's personal to you.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I just couldn't shake my prejudice.
Yeah, your bias.
Yeah.
So how do you feel like that kind of, not set you back, but what was it like when you realized that in terms of your progression with recovery?
You know what? It was what my disease was going to hang on to get me out of there.
Yeah.
Like, they're lying to you. This is religion. It's a cult. You know, even though these people that I met were absolutely beautiful and life was already slowly getting better, it was the one thing that was going to take me out, and I was really lucky that I'd gone through the steps and I was working with a sponsor, and there was like this light bulb moment after a year where I was like, oh, it says to your own understanding, even though I know, Keely, we've been reading about this.
Yeah, you've not listened
at all. Like, my mind was so shut. And so I came up with my own conception, and that's Freddie Mercury, and still is today. Like, 5.5 years later, I pray to Freddie every morning, and I love it.
And it works for you.
It works.
Yeah.
And the obsession was removed. As soon as I connected with Freddie, the obsession was removed.
I bet you didn't expect that at first, for that to be the breakthrough. Awesome. So we'll revisit that after the break. So we're going to play a quick track. This is You Started Something by Crazy P.
Ooh.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio. Today I'm sitting down with Keely, and Keely has been explaining her journey through alcoholism and recovery. So we were just talking about some of the 12 steps involved in the 12-step recovery program. We were talking a little bit about the phrase higher power, and the fact that it's not God in a strict sense. It's a higher power of your own understanding.
Yeah.
And the difference that that made to you in realizing that. So if you could walk me through, I guess, some of the other steps as part of the 12 steps, and the ones that you identified with, the ones that you struggled a bit with.
Yeah. So for me, like, and it's suggested that step one is the most important step, and we have to get that.
Yep.
The other steps you can be willing to work towards, but step one, if you can't admit that you're an alcoholic and your life has become unmanageable, it's a bit tricky.
Yeah, right.
But I had step one down pat. Like, I knew 100.
That's like the foundation.
Oh my word! Of course, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. You know, I'll be honest though. Like, the second part of step one, I was like, I don't think my life's unmanageable. Yeah. I mean, I'm drink driving with the kids in the car. I'm physically abusive to this beautiful man that I'm with.
Yep.
I'm blackout drunk. I can't hold my bodily fluids, but...
but I'm still doing it.
The house is clean.
I'm still living, yeah.
and like, I think that was me through life. If I present on the outside, you will not see the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And realizing that kind of unmanageability is more within.
Yes, yeah.
Then I was able to connect to it. But I struggled definitely. Like, I've gone through the steps now 3 times. The first time was really hard because it was hard to get my head around the high power idea.
Mm.
And it was hard to get completely honest in my step four, kind of going through my past and my resentments and my fears. And it is so hard apologizing, making amends to people. Oh,
accountability.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I'm more than happy to say sorry, but my sorries before I came into recovery was, I'm really sorry that I behaved this way, but you know, there was always a but.
A caveat,
If you hadn't have pushed the buttons, if she hadn't have, like, it was never actually then my fault.
And
know?
So that's step 8 that you're talking about.
Step 9, making amends to people that we harm.
Mm-hmm. Amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Yeah. So I guess that can be kind of tricky, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't want to make it too loaded of a apology.
Well, what's really cool, like, from my experiences, I've done all my who I've harmed, and I've got a list of names, and I can sit down with my sponsor and we can go through each and every one, and through her guidance, you actually don't need to make an amends for this. You actually didn't do anything wrong, or this is going to harm somebody if you go ahead and kind of attack them with apologies.
Yeah. How did you get involved with that sponsor?
My first sponsor, I was at a meeting, I was 3 months sober, and she was sharing something like when she'd come in that she felt like she was drowning and she was just keeping her head above water.
Mm.
And I just related so much and asked her straight after the meeting if she would sponsor me. And I didn't really know much about it. I just heard people say, this is what you got to do. This is what, now we're really lucky in my area. At a lot of meetings at the end for the newcomers, there'll be a part where they'll, if you're available to sponsor, please put your hand up. So you don't have to kind of like, you're asking for a first date and waiting to be rejected. We're here. Uh-huh. We're here to help.
Yeah.
And you can just go up. And
I guess that's so interesting in terms of, you just have to kind of follow people's advice.
Yes.
Take a leap of faith. I guess that kind of aligns with the belief in the higher power itself kind of thing.
Yeah. It's cool because they say in AA, suggestions, because we're a little bit known for being a bit, rebellious. If you tell me what to do, I'm going to do the opposite.
Rebel without a cause. Yeah.
So if, if we suggest, it's up to you, I suggest you do the steps. If you don't want to do it, then that's entirely up to you. I suggest you come back to meetings if you don't want to do it. Like, that's what I love about AA. It's, I need the discipline of the program, but I can show up to meetings and never go through the step work if I wanted to.
Right.
You know, it's there's no rules per se.
Cool. So what about your life today? So how has your sobriety progressed over the last, is it 5.5 years?
Yeah. 5.5 years?
Yeah. How's that been?
Massive. Mm. Massive. The first year was horrible. And then every year since has just slow. It's so weird because it's like that onion, you know, the layers, they just keep peeling off. It's a really big friggin' onion.
Yeah. Sobriety's a huge onion.
Yeah. And it's, you know, once I'm no longer just thinking about, I just want to drink, you know, I get to, like I said, I get to learn about myself and how I behave, but see like patterns that I've done my whole entire life that just aren't healthy, or how I treat people, or how I'm not going to do something without getting something in return, you know, and I learn all this stuff that I had no idea was on offer in AA. I learn how to be a better mother, a better partner, like, and it's not because it's written down in the book. It's just as I work with my sponsor, if they've had experiences similar to mine, they just share how they navigated those things. So, you know, my recovery's changed from that first year. Like, I had to do a meeting every single day in the first year and we were in lockdown.
Oh, okay.
What? Oh my God.
Okay. Yeah. So the online meetings. Yeah. So how'd you go with those?
Oh, it was horrible. I mean, I suppose the meetings were okay, but being locked in with my children sober, I'm scared of them again.
Yeah, facing reality a little bit.
Yeah.
And so many other people are drinking to cope, obviously.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, so, you know, I was doing a meeting every day. Today, what it looks like is, you know, it probably helps that I'm a little OCD. So I'm quite strict with my routine and I start every single morning with a guided meditation, reading from a book, an AA literature, and prayer.
Yep.
To Freddie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very relaxed. I don't get down on my knees. I sit on my bed.
Yeah.
And then I go about my day, but because I'm a sponsor, so I have at the moment 6 sponsees, and you know, so some of them are very new. We do daily check-ins. I do step work every week with sponsees, depending where they're at.
How did you go getting from 1 sponsee to 6, that process?
It's overwhelming.
Yes, yeah.
But once I'm reminded that, like, some people are like, I'm just a conduit from, let's say, Freddie.
I'm just
a channel. When I remind myself of that, it's really beautiful. When I start to think that I've got some responsibility of their recovery, it gets a bit suffocating for myself, but that's just of my own doing, you know. It's been amazing. My life has gone from my phone never rung. Remember when you like would buy a ringtone and you wanted someone to ring it so you could hear what it sounded like?
Check it out.
And now I can never stand my ringtone because it's busy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you got six of those sponsees.
Yeah, and like all the other connections within AA. But, you know, currently I do like three meetings per week. I have a weekly check-in with my sponsor. I've got a lot of beautiful friends in AA. I've got a home group. I do service in AA. But what is so amazing is the life outside, what AA has given me to be a present mother. Like, I've got boys now that are teenagers, and to be able to be there for them completely present is just something I never thought could actually happen.
Yeah.
You know?
And having them kind of, I guess they're still young, but like seeing your progression,
into
sobriety and like probably noticing like a huge difference.
Yeah.
And like
you being well, you know, they have 2 households. One is completely sober and the other would appear to be in active alcoholism.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's really awesome that they can see the 2 different ways, you know, which is a bit tricky because there is a middle ground and they're not actually seeing that. Because my husband doesn't drink.
Yeah.
But, you know, I suppose it's a safe space that I didn't have as a kid growing up that I'm so grateful that they've got.
Yeah. You've given them that perspective, I guess, which is great.
Yeah.
In terms of, the actual meetings you're attending, would you mind sharing some details where they kind of are, how people can get involved?
Yeah. So the best way I found was going on AA Times to look up meetings. The meetings that I go, like my home group, it's like the meeting that you show up every week to without fail,
you know.
You do service, is Eastern Twilight, which is in, I think it's classes One Turner.
Okay. We'll put the details in the podcast, which you can find on the Living Free page on 3CR for anyone interested.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I also do like a Tuesday night meeting, where it's a women's only meeting. So that's beautiful just to have that space with women.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there's so many meetings. There are so many meetings.
Yeah.
Like you could literally do a morning, lunch, evening meeting every day.
Yeah. Take your pick. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what's been cool. Like I've realized that if I don't like this one, that's okay. There's so many other different ones to go to.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just that, exploring, not just kind of shutting the door because one meeting's made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. What I kind of notice, from the outside looking in, I've not been to a meeting myself, but, I'm going to try and attend one next week with the help of Michael and, check it out for myself. But there is a really, practical balance of the freedom to kind of do it however you want to do it.
Yeah.
But once you find out how you want to do it and personalize it to yourself, there is that foundation for yourself, and there is that more kind of not rigid, but it gives you that discipline once you kind of sink your teeth into it.
Yeah.
So you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, is there any advice you would have given to yourself when you're in the throes of active addiction or things that, you know, you could have told yourself?
You're not a bad person.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're okay. Unwell.
Yeah.
Because I was convinced I was just a horrible human being. So, and I think that, you know, ask for help. Like it was really hard for me to do that. I always hoped that somebody would see how much I was struggling and would kind of come in and save the day. Cause I couldn't say it myself. I would hope someone would come and take the kids and look after them. I'd just be kind to yourself.
Yeah. Great message.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone can benefit from that advice, you know?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so we might wrap things up. All the details as to meetings and where you can find out where to attend a meeting, we'll put that in the podcast description that you can find on the Living Free page on 3CR Radio. So thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
This was so much fun.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. You feel good at the end of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got to tell your story and I've learned a lot about you.
Awesome.
So that's great. Tune in next week for more Radical Radio and for more Living Free. And thank you for listening. And coming up as well is a song by Everything But The Girl called Troubled Mind.
Don't say one thing one day, then something else the next day. I'm trying to keep up with you. It's hard enough when you speak clearly. When you're confused, it's like a good stream running through these rooms. And I'm reading more into your words than you have put into them. And that's my problem, that you tie these knots.
If you're struggling with drugs, alcohol, gambling or food, or concerned about somebody in the place, tune into the Living Free Show on 3CR.
Because with your troubled mind, you're like a good stream running through my life. With your troubled mind, you're like a good stream. Untouched, unknown, you look up to the sky.